We know that once a person is perverted, it is practically impossible for that person to adjust to normal attitudes in regard to sex.
Junk Food Dinner 578. Leave your attention span at home. It's short speak. First, a square from the 60s teaches us that porn is bad in perversion for profit. Next, a man videotapes wildlife in unedited footage of a bear. Finally, giant monsters destroy a garden in Kaiju Bunraku.
Male and female alike are hardened in cynical contempt of human life and values.
Welcome to Junk Food Dinner, episode 578. This is the podcast where each week we scour the internet, video stores, and cable television, searching for the most outrageous and interesting cult films. In Ohio, I am Kevin Moss, and I'm joined by California co-host Parker Bowman in the 559 and Sean Byron in LA. This week, it's hot as hell, so it's only natural that we're slipping into some comfortable shorts. The shorts we've got this week, of course, are Perversion for Profit from 1965, unedited footage of a bear from 2014, and Kaiju Bunraku from 2017. But first, gentlemen, how you doing this week?
I'm doing good.
Yeah, staying cool.
I'm trying to stay cool. Actually, yesterday I woke up and I was cold.
What?
Yeah, I couldn't even understand it. I took the dogs out at like 8 in the morning and I was like, oh, it's chilly. I need to go get a jacket. And then I checked the thermometer. It was like, I mean, it was like 85 degrees already. I have no idea how it happened.
To see maybe whether or not your angel is a centerfold? I've heard that can make your blood run cold.
Well, I think that is what happened. I think just after like so many 115 degree days, like I was like, ooh, 85, chilly. Ooh, it was cozy.
Let's hope it's that and not that your health is declining rapidly to the point where you're going to be, you're going to be looking for another co-host. Yeah.
I was actually just bleeding to death accidentally.
You've been shot. You didn't know it.
Yeah.
Other than walking puppies around, anything notable going on up there?
No.
Did you see the news today about Visalia, by the way?
What happened up here?
Well, congratulations, Mr. Bowman. Your urban metro area, and I use the word urban very loosely here, has been declared the worst air quality in the country, number one.
Oh, yeah. We've been number one for years and years and years. We also have the lowest quality of life. We're always in the top five for that, too. So,
congratulations. You guys top the list yet again. L.A., not too far behind. We're at number three, so... You know, we're no slouches ourselves down here at shitty air quality, so I see you.
Yeah. Also, it came out today that you're not going to be able to buy high-powered gaming computers in California anymore due to a power-saving law that we have. So it's just a real hellhole here. You can't even get out of the bad air quality by playing video games indoors.
Personally, I blame Bitcoin.
Why would you blame Bitcoin?
It's all these motherfuckers buying these GPUs up, Bowman, and running little Bitcoin farms in their closet, contributing to our global warming, burning down our forestries. It's got to be Bitcoin.
It might be Bitcoin. I don't know enough about it. I just know I better goddamn be able to play Bloodborne when it comes to PC. That's all I know.
Did you say buy me Bloodborne or go to hell?
Yeah,
I
did.
I, for one, appreciate that these Democrats finally found out a way to ban violent video games.
It's like how they had to get Al Capone on, like, tax charges because they couldn't get him any other way.
Exactly.
We finally got that Mortal Kombat, boys.
Just in time.
Mm-hmm. Just in time for part 13 to come out.
I faced danger to pursue nerdy events this weekend. I went to the Comic-Con, not the San Diego Comic-Con. That wasn't happening. But don't tell that to Dayton, Ohio. They still had their Gem City Comic-Con. And you want to talk about a party? Those kids were getting loose.
Really? Was Lance Henriksen there?
No Lance.
Damn it.
But no, the Gem City Comic Con is a much smaller affair, as you would imagine. No celebrities, mostly just, you know, artists and writers of comic books that most people would not know. In fact, I didn't know any of them, but they, you know, they list their credits. You're like, oh, yeah, like I did Spider-Man for 4 years. Hell yeah.
Who you got? You got a Stan Sakai there?
I don't know.
The guy that made Usagi Yojimbo? Did he show up?
I have no idea.
Come on.
They're all anonymous to me. I like going to the local creators, you know, right to the sources of these people creating, you know, sleazy horror comics in their mom's basement. That's my crowd.
You like that real underground photocopied shit?
You would be surprised. I think people have access to some professional printing these days, thanks to the internet and, you know, people just wanting tangible things. But yeah, they do. You can print up a pretty professional looking comic book these days with not a lot of money. But I mean, as long as there's, you know, they're writing about something goofy, I'm there. But yeah, it was fun to see some people. I mean, it was the first kind of convention type thing I've been to since, you know, obviously the COVID-19 thing. And it was, like I said, far from a huge gathering of the Juggalos, but it was still fun to dig through old boxes of famous monsters of film land looking for gold. But it's funny, I left purchasing mostly records. I found a guy with some old records, and that's why I spent this money. So I left the Comic-Con with a bag full of records like a true nerd.
Anything comic book related in that run of records, like the Spider-Man theme on 45 or anything like this?
No, I found this guy. He had the weirdest collection. It was like all old, like 60s rock and roll, which I'm into. And it was then like 80s hip hop. And that was it. Like it was like, I don't know, it was like a father son mixed their collection together. It was just one guy that was just like went from, you know, the fucking Ventures to Run DMC. But either way, I picked a little bit of both. I got some Digital Underground. I got some old Hot Rod LPs with these instrumental Hot Rod music on them. Stuff like that. Bargain basement prices, baby.
That's how they do it in the Gem City.
That's right.
Did you pick up that Dr. Creep comic?
I did get that Dr. Creep comic.
Nice.
Yeah, I'll pick up any Dr. Creep memorabilia that's there. There's some fun cosplayers. There was a pretty movie perfect Planet of the Apes guy there that I wanted to take a picture with, but didn't get a chance to.
Was there like too long of a line, or were you just shy?
I'm just too shy. Hush, hush, shy do I?
I didn't want to disappointing.
I didn't want to bother them. I mean, I always feel weird. Like, I mean, he's just there minding his own business, looking
That's the whole reason he dresses like an ape, is he wants people to come up and take photos with him. You don't dress up like an ape and then just go, like, mind your own business.
It's true. But, maybe next time.
Yeah, we're going to get you a photo with a Planet of the Ape Man. next time we're all at a convention together, we're getting that photo.
It almost sounds like Bowman is trying to insinuate that, based on the way he's dressed, he was asking for it.
Yeah, if you go out at night by yourself dressed up like a Dr. Zaius, Cornelius, somebody like this, I think that people are entitled to get what they want from you. I mean, call me crazy.
I will say that is
perfect. Yeah.
That is one aspect that's very cringy, is there is, as you can imagine, you know, a lot of girls who may be of questionable age, dressed up, you know, in a sexy whatever outfit, like whatever superhero, anime, whatever, but you know, showing off some T and or A, and then you've got these creepy old dudes coming up like, can I get a picture with you? You look great, that's awesome. And it's like, oh god,
is the worst picture ever made.
I feel like the Sex Pistols in that interview, just like, you dirty old bastard.
It's vulgar.
But yeah, that was my weekend. Hanging out with the creeps at the Comic-Con.
Pretty exciting stuff. I mean, I've got nothing to compete. Once again, spent the entire week indoors, mostly in my living room. But I did see a few things. Saw that new Woodstock 99 documentary on HBO Max.
Yeah, nice.
Pretty good. I mean, I was a little bit disappointed with it in terms of like it's very clear that they had one story that they wanted to tell, and they kind of mined that well pretty exhaustively over the course of like almost 2 hours or something. I could have used a little bit more variety with like the interview subjects, like for instance, no Insane Clown Posse interviews. I'm sure those guys would have said yes to an interview. But otherwise, pretty good, worth watching for sure if you want that nostalgia trip. Did you get a chance to watch that, Kevin or Bowman?
I have not. No, but I do find Woodstock 99 fascinating, as you know, that was kind of like when we were, you know, teenagers, like theoretically this was the music of our generation. It's just the worst shit possible, and it kind of is the, you know, closing thesis to my argument that the late 90s, early 2000s was one of the worst times for pop culture in all of history, especially music, but just awful.
It's pretty rough. Like the lineup is 90%, you know, core and derivatives, but there's a little bit of light in there. Like, you know, DMX, I think was a good act on the lineup, and his performance was pretty cool to see. Cause I don't remember ever seeing DMX's performance there. You know, the weird thing about Woodstock 99, I don't know if you guys remember that it was like a pay-per-view event. Do you guys remember the pay-per-view associated with this? And I watched a lot of that back in the day, but I didn't remember a lot of stretches of what's covered in this. So yeah, worth watching.
Do they discuss the multiple rapes that happened there?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the central concern of it, to be honest. It is kind of a cool summer documentary. So it's mostly that, and then just kind of also ancillary stuff about the poor planning that went into it for things like toilets, et cetera. But it's crazy. Like, those photos you see of people covered in mud, you know, at the 94 Woodstock, like, that's mud. And at the 99 Woodstock, no, that's shit. Like, the toilets broke and nobody realized, because they were all out of their minds because it was like 200 degrees the whole weekend. Anyways, worth watching. I also rewatched City Slickers, which I hadn't seen since I was like a kid. I liked it as a kid. I like it now. A lot of fun, man. All three leads are really fun. Bruno Kirby, I think, is fucking hilarious in it. It's got good pixels on HBO Max right now, so I'm probably going to watch that sequel this week, and I'll let you know if I like that still. And then I also went out and saw, well, not went out, but went out to my living room and saw Singing in the Rain. Trying to connect with Gene Kelly, and I feel like I still haven't fully connected with the guy. I didn't really fall in love with him through Singing in the Rain, but I did love the movie. And, you know, I guess I'm coming to appreciate his talents. He's just kind of not one of my dudes specifically, but if you haven't seen it, I mean, this is news to nobody, but great musical. If you somehow, like me, had never seen it, it's out there and easy to see again on HBO Max.
Did you see Gene Kelly's performance at Woodstock 99?
No, I mean, I wish that for me, like, that's what I was waiting for through the whole documentary. And, you know, when I said that they focused on one area to the detriment of others, what I was specifically talking about was, yeah, where's Gene Kelly? You hear so much about it, and then it's not in the documentary.
Yeah, well, he did it all for the Nookie.
Man, that documentary is it's definitely worth a watch. What a weird point in time that was.
Yeah. Weird, I guess, is a way to put it. I would say awful. I lived it. Do you know anyone that went to Woodstock 99? I had a couple friends that went.
I don't think so, no. I mean, I probably if I, like, you know, asked around, maybe I could find some, but not off the top of my head, no, I don't think so.
Yeah. They all had a bad experience.
Of course. When you just see, like, the crowd and, like, how... I mean, I know all the festivals are crowded and people get packed shoulder to shoulder, but like the extent to which this was shoulder to shoulder and then like encircled by these like army built security fences, you know, like it just looks like hell on earth. And that's without, you know, having to listen to Korn.
What a time. What a time.
It's wild to see what Offspring looks like in 2020, though, or 2021, whenever they shot them. They don't look the same. They got older.
Well, yeah, I would think so. But yeah, playing the worst music of all time will certainly age you. Fucking Offspring.
Well, come on, you're being too harsh on them. They were probably one of the better bands that played that year. Come on. Corn. You say Offspring's worse than Corn, Limp Bizkit, Disturbed, Cold Chamber.
Yes.
Sepultura.
Offspring are aggressively annoying. Like they're putting the annoying right in your face. Just going to deal with it. And I say no.
Don't you guys forget about the Electronica tent that they had there as well, because Moby was a big headliner of that Electronica tent. And maybe the funniest moment in the documentary is, and spoiler, I guess, for this documentary, but he shows up to the festival, and they got this big banner out front that they spent a lot of time making this banner with everybody's names, every single performer, you know, even like side acts, who it's like, I don't know who the hell that guy is. They got every performer up there on this banner, except for Moby. And he makes the biggest deal about it, like little crybaby. And he's so bummed that he's not on the Woodstock 99 banner. And it's like, dude, you dodged a bullet. But yet, like 30 years later, he's still complaining about it.
He's also still complaining he didn't get the chance to have sex with 15-year-old Natalie Portman.
Yeah. I mean, for a documentary that is so focused on sexual abuse, they shied away from that subject.
Weird. Well, yeah, I'll have to check that out. Relive my glory days.
Gotta get that Max.
Yeah, good Lord. Well, let's check out what sort of nostalgic nonsense the folks out there in Junk Food Dinnerland have been getting into this week in this week's segment of Junk Mail. We got a nice mailbag full of junk mails this week. First call comes to us from Kevin in Oakland, who has this to say.
Hey, it's Kevin E. in Oakland, California, and he just finished listening to the Kai July show, and here to answer Kevin Moss's pertinent question about Godzilla and his new power. You remember after the fight, the first fight, that he's in the water and he gets struck by lightning, which probably activated something in him, like with King Kong and Godzilla, and made him, I don't know, made him magnetic. You know, after with the second fight, there's a point when Godzilla went Dragon Ball Z-ish and started to have this blue glow and this sparkling around him, and that's when he became magnetic. So, there you go. Here to answer all your pertinent Godzilla questions. Later, boys.
Well, thank you, Kevin, for calling in and giving us the insight into how Godzilla became magnetic and Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla that we talked about a couple weeks ago. I don't know. That makes sense. I'm willing to buy it. I guess that just wasn't... I need things spelled out for me. I can't just infer these things. I don't know how the science of Godzilla works. Would you think getting hit by lightning would make you magnetic? I've never seen that happen before.
Didn't that happen in Ernest Goes to Jail?
God damn it, you're right. And when you're right, you're right.
The science is there.
I forgot to reference my Ernest medical journal.
I've got a big whiteboard on my wall of like all the things Ernest ever did. So I just had to look up real quick at it. But it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I think so. If that's how Ernest laid it out, I tend to agree. Who am I to challenge Ernest and his knowledge of kaijus?
All right. Our next call comes to us from our old pal, and who was sadly missed last episode when we talked about State Park, considering he's been hyping it. But it is our old pal Shelby who has...
Oh. Hello, cowards. It's your old pal Shelby calling from the Gaylord Center at National Harbor in Prince George's County, Maryland. I wanted to call in with a regret. I know you guys love to hear regrets. My greatest regret is that I agreed to come on your show and do State Park, aka Heavy Metal Summer, as part of a October or September theme show about guys in bear suits, only to be stabbed in the fucking back and have you guys review it without me. So I certainly regret ever trusting Junk Food Dinner with their word. Anyways, as I knew you would, you guys forgot two of the most exciting parts of the film, which were A, the voyeuristic sex ducks, And B, I don't know if anyone noticed this, but there's the most amazing scene ever in that movie where I think it's Truckee. He's about to jump in the lake and, you know, the ladies are like looking at his butt and stuff. And when I saw this, I fucking freaked out. I filmed my TV and sent it to Eric from Ilcon. He does this shit where he's about to jump in the lake and he's wearing a pair of shorts and he drops his shorts only to reveal that he has cut off denim shorts underneath his shorts. And it's not paid off like a gag or anything. It's like, it's just like a thing that happened in the 80s. I guess you just wear cut off denim shorts underneath your swim shorts so that you can swim in the cut off denim shorts. I don't know. That's the best part of the movie. None of you guys brought it up. I regret ever listening to your show, but I still love you guys. And keep doing what you're doing. I'm not going to listen anymore because I hate you, but it's a great show. Keep it up. Bye, guys.
Thank you, Shelby, for calling in. And I apologize. Let me take this chance to officially apologize. Parker, you want to explain the scheduling snafu that happened with State Park?
Well, I mean, it was, yeah, I mean, I put it on the list because it was a Patreon pick.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were talking to Shelby and we're like, hey, like we started talking about this bear show idea where people dress up like bears. And we
and
were
then
like,
you go ahead and do unedited footage of a bear this week just to put salt in the wound.
Yeah, this is pretty jacked up when you consider he's establishing a pattern here. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
Shelby's been nothing but nice to us, supported us for years. And so continue.
Okay. So we were like, all right, we should do this bear show in the future. But then I was like, oh no, I remember now that I put State Park on the calendar for the immediate next week. And, you know, that's how it is. And then Shelby, he like.
It was too late to turn the train around at that point.
Yeah, he had plans to bake cookies with his grandmother, he said, which is really weird. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so we couldn't do it. But, I mean, you know, it's so often that we, you know, we got such long lists of movies we want to do. I'm glad we just finally got to check one off the list, even if it hurt Shelby's feelings. Like, if we wouldn't have done it that week,
friend for life.
So the logic here is that we have such a long list of movies that we could do that we had to do this one.
What was I gonna do? It was the next week. I can't take it off the list.
So it sounds like to me, if I can just parse this and maybe, you know, help you out here, it sounds like you're trying to, you know, effectively shift the blame to our Patreon donor who picked the film. Is that what you're doing here?
Once I put the list of movies, the monthly movies, on our website, junkfooddinner.com. That's it. It's final. There's no going back. We cannot change it once it's been uploaded to the website. What am I going to do? Go in there and push it.
That's fair. Shelby, you got to understand, we live a fucking breakneck lifestyle over here. We're doing 3 movies a week, every week. Sometimes feelings are going to get hurt. Hearts are going to get broken. You know what? But you're welcome on the show anytime if you were willing. If you'd be willing to come back to us, we'll do any movie you want, even if it's ghoulish. I'll regret saying that, but I don't know. Yeah. We'd love to have you on the show.
So. I've never in my life seen Roadhouse, and I know that Shelby thinks less of me because of that. So why don't you bring Roadhouse onto the show, Shelby Cobras?
Or better
by
yet.
By the way, we're doing Roadhouse next week, so that nice. Might not be the best idea.
No.
I was going to say, you know, even better yet, Shelby, if need be, we'll kick Bowman off the show for you. You know what? You come. Bowman doesn't have to be there. You know, you can figure out some other way to spend his evening. Yeah.
Well, that works out well because I'm actually going on tour with Vastum this summer. So I'm going to be busy anyway.
Well, all right. Shelby, I hope you can forgive us. And I appreciate your additional insight into State Park. We could have really used that last week, but, you know, things happen. All right. Next caller. This comes to us from Nick, who's in Des Moines, Iowa. Is that where Slipknot's from? Oh, okay. Well, let's talk to this dude from Slipknot.
Hey, guys. This is Nick from Des Moines, Iowa. I was listening to your 4th of July episode. And you were talking about food service, and it reminded me of a story probably from 94 to 96 I lived downtown, and I lived the main drag was down here with Ingersoll Avenue, and had all the bars and restaurants and all the shops. So on Friday and Saturday nights, you'd go up and down Ingersoll. It's called the Ingersoll Crawl. You'd make your way to all the bars. By the end of the night, everybody would make the journey to the Ingersoll Hardee's. You'd go into the drive-thru, you would order all your shit, pull around, they would charge you, they would tell you one amount at the drive-thru. You pull around, they would charge you a different amount at the window. When you would look in the window, it was a madhouse in there. They were having too much fun. And then it would give you sacks, and every time without fail, never what you ordered. It was always something new. I tried so much new shit doing that. They were fucking patriots and goddamn heroes in there, and I miss those days. And I guess that dovetails with my only regret that I never went to that Hardee's enough. All right, keep up the good work, guys. Love you. Bye.
Well, thank you, Nick, for calling in. I appreciate Tales from the Fast Food Wasteland. That's always a good and a regret. So you knocked it out of the park with that call. I appreciate it. Hardee's, man, you guys call it Carl's Jr. out there. We got Hardee's out here. Same shit. But we don't have any Hardee's anymore. They like all disappeared, at least in the greater Cincinnati area. So I don't have access to a Hardee's anymore. I used to love the old Hardee's, especially back in the day when those moose cups. They're that moose mascot. You guys remember that at all?
I don't remember that moose.
No.
Oh my god! Well, never mind.
Carl's Jr. Yeah. Just has the weird like Mario star kind of character. Yeah.
Well, that's what Hardee's has now, since Carl's Jr. rebranded it. But, yeah, I don't know. They had some good burgers. And I love to hear about people partying at Hardee's, because that's where else are you going to party? Party hardy. That's where that phrase came from.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And I love the caller's, you know, positivity here.
He was getting bad service, but exactly. He rolled with it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like me in that same situation, I'm pulling a guy through the drive-thru window, you know what I mean? Where's my fucking double quarter pounder?
He was going with my philosophy that I was talking about on the 4th of July show. You got to roll with it. You made the choice to go through the drive-thru. You get what you get.
Yeah.
And you get what you deserve.
I fucked up. I mean, I guess the secret is you should just be looking at life like it's one big Ingersoll crawl.
Yeah. I mean, you're already taking your health and your life in your own hands eating that shit. Would you want service with a smile, too? Come on. Get real. It's the real world out there. But anyway, final caller. It is Will from Richmond, and he has this to say.
Hey, Junk Food Dinner guys. It's Will from Richmond, and Junk Food Dinner girl, too. Sure. I'd like to strongly recommend a comic book, Ultra Mega. It is like Ultraman, kaiju fighting comic book, super good stuff. Highly recommended. I am really interested in checking out that movie 80 Blocks from Tiffany's. I'm really into 70s and 80s gang movies. Our Switchblade Sisters is definitely one of my favorites. Could you guys recommend any other kind of gang movies from that era? I have also already seen The Warriors, of course. And, that's it. No regrets. I'm doing perfectly right now. Couldn't be better. Take care.
Beautiful. Thank you for calling in. Will, yeah, glad you liked the 80 Blocks from Tiffany's review. Yeah, gang movies from back in the day. I mean, you know, I obviously The Warriors, Switchblade Sisters, those are some of the first ones I think of as well.
What about Mad Foxes?
Oh, yeah. That's some gang action. Deadbeat at Dawn, if you've never seen that. I mean, it's not 70s, but it captures that 70s exploitation vibe. And you've got the mean gangs of Dayton, Ohio on the mean streets. What else?
I don't know. I only watch shows and movies about law-abiding citizens. I don't watch that gang stuff. It's too violent.
Are you familiar with this this Ultra Mega? Did he talk about this comic book? It looks pretty cool. Like you said, it looks like Ultraman, and I like the style and the color palette. It looks like it's pretty fun.
Yeah, same. I'd never seen this before, but it looks really cool. I like this. This like purpley blue kind of cover that I'm looking at here is a really interesting color palette.
Yeah.
It's an Image comic, apparently.
There you go.
I'll check it out. This looks pretty rad.
Yeah, I'm down. As long as Rob Liefeld doesn't get a cut of my purchase.
And then, Will, let me ask you this question. Are you familiar? I saw this place online the other day in Richmond, Virginia. It's called Wax Moon. It's a goth record store / horror movie store / horror-themed pinball place. And the building is all black, painted black. And it looks cool as hell. So let me know if you've ever been to Wax Moon there in Richmond, Virginia, and tell me if it's as cool as it looks. That's your assignment for next week.
I think we should start giving out more assignments to callers.
You call in, I might have an assignment for you. I might have to go on assignment, do some research, some reconnaissance work for me. But if you'd like to get in the reconnaissance mission or just tell us what you think of the show, tell us some regrets, tell us your favorite gang-related movie, or call to tell us how much of a grudge you're going to hold against us for doing State Park without you. You can give us a call at the Junk Food Dinner voicemail line at 347-746-JUNK. That's 347-746-5865. If you can't remember all those wonderful digits, you can always go to our Facebook page on your cellular device and hit the big fat call now button, and you will be connected to the Junk Food Dinner voicemail line. All right, that being said, let's get into some nerd news.
From the global resources of Junk Food Dinner Worldwide, it's time for Nerd News.
The first piece of Nerd News is a little bit of a lost film has been found. The fact of the matter is with art, most of it's lost, gone to time. Art preservation, they do what they can, but most of art ever made, dust. And unfortunately, that's the case with a lot of old film as well. But all film fans, always hold out hope that maybe one day some of those lost films will surface. And that is in just the case as a short version of the 1935 Japanese film, Kaiguya Haimi, was found in a British film library. The film.
Now tell me, who was the source of this videotape?
Well, I will tell you, and that is, like I said, some British film library found this 35 minutes of this lost film. It was originally 75 minutes, so sadly, it's not the whole film that has been found. It is a movie called basically the tale of the bamboo cutter, which is an old Japanese folklore tale. And what's notable about this Japanese movie from 1935 is that it has some pretty famous people working on it, including a guy named Eiji Tasubura, who was the director of photography on this, who would go on to do special effects on the original Godzilla from 1954, as well as the Ultraman TV show. So he's, a pretty heavy hitter in the world of Japanese special effects, and this is some of his earliest work. And apparently you get to see some of his, skills in early composite techniques and making some different early 1935 special effects on this. Also, apparently, working on this movie was Kenzo Masayoka, who was dubbed the father of Japanese anime. He was in charge of doing stop motion and puppet animation on this movie, but unfortunately, of the 35 minutes that was found, not a lot of his stop motion work from the film is included in that 33-minute short. But again, this British researcher, like I said, found this in this British Film Institute catalog. And again, it's always, and this is going to be screening throughout Japan as part of a celebration of this you know, finding of this lost film, and I'm hopefully it'll come either to the internet or on some sort of disc soon. But I don't know. While this 35 minutes of this 1935 Japanese movie might not sound amazing, like I said, just its significance because of its early special effects work. And I'm a kind of guy that I like to go back and especially see early stuff. You know, I like to see how the magic tricks evolves over time. And I think this probably has some interesting historical significance. So even if it's not a story or, you know, a movie that I'd probably rush out to see, just the fact that it's been found again gives hope that maybe other lost or thought to be lost works might see the light of day at some point. But did you hear about this story? And if so, any thoughts? I know, Sean, you've been on a Japanese kick this month. How does this historical Japanese cinema strike you?
Echo. I'm interested, just like you are. You know, I didn't know anything about this title before you sent me the story, and I hadn't heard that it had been found. But yeah, like you, it just kind of brings hope that they'll find other things, you know, and that they're, you know, it's cool to see that there's still effort being put into locating these, you know, old ass movies that, I mean, honestly, really have a pretty limited interest, like commercially. Like there's probably no chance that whatever money they spend restoring this is going to be recouped through sales. So I'm thankful that people put in these efforts, and, you know, hopefully there's, you know, responsible, you know, nonprofits and things like this funding efforts like this, because I would potentially be one of those few people who would dip into, you know, giving this a shot, you know, and it'd be cool to see those early special effects, you know, see how they developed.
For sure.
Yeah, I agree. I'm down. Anytime somebody finds a lost film, I'm into it. Cause yeah, like, you know, there's like some crazy stat about it. Like 90% of the movies made before 1950 or something were lost. Like, I mean, that's probably not the exact stat, but it's something like that. Like it's something like astronomical. So anytime, you know, one of these turns back up, it's a cause for celebration.
Yeah, it is wild. Like, what was going on pre-1950? Was it like, boss, what do you want me to do with this film? Like, we showed it once, throw it in the fucking garbage. What are we supposed to keep it around forever?
Yeah, just chuck it.
I mean, probably a lot of it, right, is just how fragile film is, right? Like, true. I'm sure that there were a number of companies who were like, yeah, we're going to store all of our films. We're just going to throw them in this closet. It'll be fine. And then they go and check on them in 20 years, and they're like, oh, no, everything is falling apart. You know, it's all turned into vinegar or whatever. But, yeah, I know that there's also that, speaking of 30s Japanese kaiju movies, there's that Japanese King Kong from 33.
Oh,
do you know about that is lost? And I mean, that would be like the, you know, the crowning achievement if they were able to find that thing, where it's like, you know, similar to how Godzilla got bastardized in America with American actors in the US release, they did a King Kong in 33 that played in Japan with all these scenes that they filmed with Japanese actors. And I think that'd be really cool to see, you know, how did they sell that to the Japanese audiences of the 30s?
Yeah. Maybe that was the justification for doing the American Godzilla. They did it to us first.
Yeah, it's official. Yeah, retaliation makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got some news for you guys. It's news you guys have been waiting a long time to hear, and that is that David Coalsmith will play young Charles in
what?
The new Chucky, the new Chucky TV show. Which the trailer for which dropped this week is going to focus a little bit on Chucky's backstory and his past, and we're finally going to see young Charles. I just couldn't be happier.
So, that's awesome.
But so the new trailer dropped this week. I watched it. I think the show looks great. It's you know, original continuity, not the remake, although I did kind of like that remake. And it continues the story. And it looks like I got an echo. And it looks creepy. It's set at Halloween. It's about a young kid finding young Charles at like a garage sale or something. And, you know, kind of young Charles just kind of fucking with this kid at school and getting him picked on and getting him in trouble and probably all leading up to some murders and stuff. And I think it looks pretty fun. It'll definitely be required Halloween time watching, I think. So did you guys get a chance to see this Young Charles trailer?
I did. I don't think it looks amazing. Let's not go nuts here. But it does look, I'm in. And I think what the hook that got me was setting it to Halloween. Those sons of, they knew how to tug at my heartstrings. And they knew if they put this out around Halloween, put a fucking jack-o'-lantern in the preview, I'll be tuning in. so I get it. You tricked me. It's a good trick, and I appreciate it. Whether or not this will be any good, yet to be determined. But I like the prospect of a new Young Charles for Halloween. You know, I'll definitely watch this in October while munching on some of that new Monster Mash cereal that's coming out this year. It sounds like it's going to be a fun Halloween. I'm already psyched.
So this is like it's a sci-fi series. So like ratings wise, it's going to be like TV-14 or whatever, or TVMA or whatever, but it's not going to have like cursing or like strong violence or anything, right?
It might. I mean, sci-fi has gotten a little more adult with it. They did that Blood Drive show, and that was TVMA with all kinds of cursing.
Yeah, the MTV Scream show, I mean, it wasn't like super gory or anything like that, but I think that there was some reasonable kills and some curse words and stuff.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I mean, you know, much like Kevin, I'm cautiously optimistic on this, I guess I would say. You know, ultimately, I think we're probably past the point of Chucky's relevancy, you know, like we live in a post Annabelle time, you know what I mean? Like killer dolls are everywhere. And I think the novelty of a Chucky in the, you know, these times is kind of diminished, but you know, he's the OG and I like him, and I'm glad that Brad Dourif's, you know, participating with his voice. So I'll give this a shot probably. But I still haven't seen that remake. So, you know, it's not like I'm keeping up. Now. Yeah. I like that news.
I can't believe you didn't see the remake, even after you met that Charles from the remake.
I know, I'm a total poser, because I was partying with the director of that movie at In-N-Out Burger on Sunset that night, where I just randomly walked into an In-N-Out, I think to use the bathroom, and that motherfucker was just in there drunk as hell, having, I think, just premiered his movie or whatever. Yeah, that was a fun night. So, yeah, to relive those memories of me partying with this drunk director at an In-N-Out Burger at 1 a.m. Yeah, I probably should watch the remake and then watch the series.
Perfect.
Well, speaking of remakes or series, I guess this is technically not a remake, but I got some news in that area. Universal and Peacock have closed a $400 million deal for a new Exorcist trilogy. Ellen Burstyn's going to be in it, blah, blah, blah. Peacock, in partnership with Blumhouse and Morgan Creek, have reported their deal. It's going to have, like I said, Ellen Burstyn reprising a role as the mother of a demon-possessed child. To be directed by David Gordon Green of Halloween, the franchise will star Hamilton's Leslie Odom Jr., so cool, I guess, as the father of a possessed child who seeks out the aid of Ellen Burstyn's character, blah, 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 blah. According to Universal, it's going to have 3 movies in total, and it's going to be a continuation rather than a remake. And the first movie in this new trilogy will be hitting theaters October of 2023, so we all got plenty of time to prep for that, and hopefully theaters are still around in October of 2023. Well, I guess that'll remain to be seen. And then subsequent installments could premiere on Peacock, according to a report in the New York Times. But I don't know. It seems like they probably haven't fully sorted that out yet. Anyhow, people, I think, are reacting to this sort of in the negative in terms of like the price ticket for this. $400 million seems like a lot of money, but I actually don't think it's as insane as some people are maybe making it out to be. If you look at the original Exorcist, its budget was $12 million, but that was 1973. And if you adjust for inflation, it's a $75 million picture. So, you know, this is not completely out of the range of, you know, what the old movies cost. And I would expect Hollywood's inflation rate to probably be higher than the country at large. So I don't think this sounds crazy. I think that they can probably make money off these movies. You know, my parents' generation, your parents' generation, our parents' generation, you know, they still feel, I think, the terrors from seeing this movie. as younger people. And same with me, you know, having seen it for the show not that long ago, I found it to be pretty frightening. So I think this franchise still has legs in terms of its name recognition. I don't think it's been spoiled to the extent that the Chucky movies maybe have been, despite Exorcist 2 and 3 not being very well loved. I feel like there's still so much reverence for that original that, you know, they'll make their money back. But anyways, do you guys have interest in a new Exorcist trilogy? I'm a guy who liked the second one, you know, despite maybe not knowing who starred in it. And I was cool-ish with the third one. But I'm kind of in the mood for more Exorcist. But what about you guys?
Is there any word whether or not the Exorcist will be teenage or not?
No word so far.
If they can get a teenage Exorcist and then license that song from Teenage Exorcist, then I will be on board.
I think licensing the song, you know, given the $400 million budget, is not going to be a problem.
Okay. But yeah, no, I had heard a little bit about this. And yeah, it does seem like a pretty high price to pay. Especially when, you know, exorcism, you don't have to call it The Exorcist. Like, you can make a movie about exorcism and call it something else. But yeah, I don't know. I like the Exorcist trilogy, the original. I don't know, though. I'm a little over these Jesus-y horror movies with religious implications. I just want monsters now. Just give me monsters.
Yeah, I like the first Exorcist, and I think that the rest are pretty not great. And yeah, they're striking while the iron is very cold on this, because The Conjuring and Insidious in those movies, like you said, Kevin, like those religious horror movies were hot a few years ago. Now not so much. So, yeah, I just can't imagine this being good. Or doing well. I think people are kind of sick of that religious horror. And, like, there's just not, like, a lot of story you can tell, like, with an exorcism. Like, you know?
I mean, I think the mechanism of possession is fun, though, in movies. Like, I agree, like, religious horror, who gives a shit? Like, is religion really relevant in 2021? Probably not. But the mechanism of possession, I don't know, I always found that to be fun, to see a character do a literal transformation in a movie and then, you know, be controlled by some other force. I think there are a lot of potential fun storylines you can come up with that kind of a mechanic. But it does depend heavily on how they choose to execute this. If it's just the same as the first movie over again, but with CGI this time, you know, and worse actors, then yeah, who needs that?
Yeah. Well, that's probably what it's going to be.
All right. Well, on that note, I think we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to get into our first short film of the evening, and that is Perversion for Profit from 1965. So stick around. I'm waiting.
high-speed presses, rapid transportation, mass distribution, all have combined to put the vilest obscenity within reach of every man, woman, and child in the country. The United States Supreme Court has described it as dirt for dirt's sake. We describe it as dirt for money's sake. This moral decay weakens our resistance to the onslaught of the communist masters of deceit.
Well, welcome back to Junk Food Dinner. The first short film we're going to be taking a look at on the show this evening is Perversion for Profit from 1965. This is a Eastman color propaganda film, and this was financed by a black spot on Cincinnati's history, a gentleman named Charles Keating. A guy who you might recall, if you've ever seen The People versus Larry Flint, as portrayed by James Cromwell in that, he was a lawyer and like college athlete, and then a guy who was a big anti-pornography activist here in Cincinnati. And he is the reason to this day there's no strip clubs, no dirty bookstores, no back in the day, no porno theaters. In Cincinnati, he was a. You can't get porno on a TV in a hotel room in Cincinnati to this day because of this dickhead. he really hated porn for some reason. But later in the 1980s, he found Lincoln Savings and Loan Association, and cost the government taxpayers $3 billion, and went to jail for many counts of fraud, racketeering, and conspiracy. So you know, it all came around in the end, but. Back in 1965, he was on his anti-pornography crusade and produced Perversion for Profit. I guess this was, you know, the short film was meant to be played, I don't know, at local, you know, church meetings or wherever your community met to get riled up about some dumb shit. And this basically is a anti-pornography, like I said, kind of propaganda film where they hired this Los Angeles newsman, George Putnam, to narrate, and he just talks about all the filthy smut that you can find at your local newsstand and barbershop. Were they selling porno at barbershops back in the day? What a time to be alive. And like malt shops and wherever magazines were sold. Apparently in 1965, there was a whole host of smut that you could pick up, and Perversion for Profit shows you that smut, at least in some censored forms, which also, despite the fact that this is like just a hilarious, like scare film, it's fun to laugh at, you know, 60 years later, it is also a cool time capsule of the porno of the time. If you like vintage porno, it's on full display here. They show pages not only from, you know, like what they call girly magazines and, you know, the filth of the time, which, by the way, is all very tame by today's standards. I mean, it's like Betty Page type shit, girls bending over provocatively and like, you know, just showing just a hint of nip, and this guy's freaking out like he's watching Two Girls One Cup. but then they show, you know, like even like the physique magazines of the time that have their homosexual undertones, and you know how pornography is like, you know, leading to the, you know, the degradation of our youth and the increase in illegitimate pregnancy and venereal disease and homosexuality among our children, all because these filthy magazines are just right there amongst the good housekeeping and the popular mechanics of the time. But for 31 minutes, he goes on and on about all this shit. And like I said, I think it's a very interesting time capsule. One, just to see, you know, obviously the hilarious outdated views, not only just of pornography, but of, you know, homosexuality and, you know, what they consider deviant sex. Again, very tame by today's standards. And if they could only see into the future, into what, because they're like, you know, pornography was like, has always been around, but now it's got the, you know, the print industry and the, you know, easy delivery methods. And it's like, boy, you have no idea what's coming around the corner. But yeah, I don't know. And so this is what Charles Keating did back in the day and scared people that pornography was going to ruin their kids' lives and everything. And like I said, because of this, you know, while this is like ancient history, being 1965 and seeming like, you know, a long time ago, again, it does have some lasting impact, especially into my life living in Cincinnati, where, like I said, the effects of Charles Keating can still be felt with our lack of any, you know, sex positive businesses in the area. But anyway, yeah, that's Perversion for Profit. I've always wanted to see this. This is, again, a very notorious kind of, you know, one of those, you know, old school propaganda films that people watch ironically now, like, you know, like a Reefer Madness and or some of those old, you know, blood on the pavement kind of scare videos for driver safety and stuff like that. They're fun to watch and they're fun to make fun of the antiquated ways and, you know, outdated ideas. And like I said, this one is also interesting because of its interesting time capsule of showing actual vintage pornography of the time. Turner Classic Movies has played this a couple times as part of its TCM Underground Nights. I can see this, you know, being a fun play to wedge in between two movies at a, you know, movie marathon. Or if you just like to get together with friends and have a couple beers and rip on some old educational films from back in the day, you'll definitely enjoy Perversion for Profit. So I had fun watching this. I mean, it's widely available. You can watch it on, it's in the public domain, so it's everywhere. It's on YouTube. It's on any video site that you can think of. But, you know, obviously, it is sad that there probably are some people that still hold not too distant views from Charles Keating and George Putnam in this video about pornography and homosexuality and weird kinks. Like
it's vulgar.
Yeah, so, you know, while it seems antiquated, I guess, by a lot of our liberal standards, again, I'm sure there's some people out there that still wholeheartedly believe a lot of this crap. But anyway, what did you guys think of Perversion for Profit, and were you as jazzed as I was to see some of the pornos that my grandpa jerked off to?
I wholeheartedly believe in what this guy has to say.
All right, well, let's hear your arguments.
There are too many goddamn perverts out here nowadays jerking off their wieners.
Pervert is back!
I just can't stand to see it. No, I this is fun. This is like so stupid and horrible that anybody had to live in a world and still lives in a world like this. I live in this world. There's like the people who live out here fully believe this crap.
You can't get an erection.
Also true, besides the point, but true. And yeah, it's like you said, like, I mean, like if you could like transport these dudes who made this like to now, their heads would explode. Like in that movie we've never done on the show, Scanners, because like, as you said, like they're talking about, oh man, like porn is insane today because, you know, they're printing it out and they're shipping it to your town on a highway. Can you fucking believe it? Like having like a, be like to go up to these dudes and be like, hey, in the future everybody's got a little machine that they carry on them at all times that can get all the porno.
Hey pal, I can get an erection anytime I want, watch.
Like it would blow their minds. So I like that about it. They also say at one point that porn is a $2 billion a year industry, which I have a hard time believing at this point.
What, do you specialize in porn?
I mean, maybe. Like, I have a hard time understanding that there was $2 billion in the entire world in the 50s.
Well, this is 1965, and what's the 60s?
65. But still, like, that seems like a lot of money for just magazines, but who knows? Like,
Did you see the boots they were wearing?
Well, true. And there were...
Those were some billion-dollar boots.
True. And there were a lot of magazines. Like, when the guy goes through the list, like, there's hundreds of them, so...
Well, that's the thing. The amount of people jerking off has never changed. It's always remained the same. But, you know, these people were willing to shell out a couple, you know, nickels for it. And those nickels add up. If you took everybody, if you had a nickel for everybody, every Pornhub video that got watched, you'd have $2 billion.
Well, that's a good point. That is a good point. And apparently they were just selling it right at your barber shop. So you could just pick it up.
It's at easy the malt to get. Shop, even.
Yeah, they were selling it at the malt shop, drugstores.
I would love to just go get a malt and a porno mag, you know?
Yeah.
I've never had that like luxury.
Like your grandfather used to.
Right.
I
feel like jerking off the way my grandpa did.
When they talk about the nudist stuff, like that part was kind of funny. It reminded me that shockingly, I don't think we've ever done any of those like 50s, 60s nudist movies, which is a real shame. Maybe.
Oh, yeah. We still got to do some Doris Wishman Nude on the Moon.
Oh, I would love to do Nude on the Moon. That's the best place to get nude.
No doubt about it.
So, but yeah, they're talking. What was that?
So that's everyone's dream.
Indeed.
Even Jeff Bezos, if he could get nude on the moon, he'd do it. He's trying.
Yeah, he's trying. He's trying
we
hard.
We did watch that house on Bear Mountain. That's kind of that maybe we're trying to say a big fuck you to Shelby for picking a bear movie, but kind of in that nudie cutie vein, right?
True. Yeah, that's adjacent. I would say that's a nudie cutie. Well, definitely a nudie cutie, but not a nudist movie. It's adjacent. It's close. That's probably the closest we've gotten. But the way that they talk about the nudist stuff in here is funny, because at one point, like, he's like, oh, can you believe these people? They get nude and they just walk around. And then, like, as a way to point out that nudists are perverts, he's like, I've never seen a blind person at a nudist colony. It's like, well, I mean, I've never seen a blind person. Like, I'm just, like, I don't know. Like, all right. So I feel like his argument was a little bit weird, but I'm sure there's blind people at nudist colonies. Like, why wouldn't they? Like, if you're blind, of course you just want to let it just be free and relaxing, get a little wind on your nuts, I would imagine.
Yeah, I don't want to fuck with clothes, and I can see. Can you imagine how hard those things are put on if you're blind?
Exactly. All those buttons.
Hey, you don't have to fuck with buttons anymore, blind person. I'd be like, fuck yeah.
Not to mention the embarrassment you would suffer if you put on a t-shirt that says, I'm with stupid, and the arrow's pointing right up at your own face. That can happen if you're blind.
It probably happens.
They used to do that to Stevie Wonder all the time.
And then, like, the one, like, all the porn they show, like, I mean, like, these people, like, I guarantee that on some level these people made this video so that they could jack off to it, because they show some titillating stuff. Like, I mean, they put like the tiniest little black bars over these boobies. Like, they put huge black bars over the girl's eyes so you can't like ID them. Tiny little bars over the boobies. Like, they're just showing you some straight up titties and nipples in this. So
I liked it.
It's like that real BBC kind of like, oh, we're going to air a documentary about Tracy Lords to show you how wrong this is, but we're going to feature, you know, 30 minutes of footage of her as a 16-year-old in porn films, so you tune in. Like, this is definitely one of those kind of documentaries. And, yeah, I was a little shocked at how scantily clad some of these ladies were in it, and how scantily clad some of these young-ass dudes in these magazines were. Like, that's one part where, like, they almost got me with this, because, like, they show some dudes in these magazines that, like, could not have been 18.
No.
And they were very young folks. So, yeah. So that part, I was on his side for that stuff, because that was a little much. Those guys were young, but, either that or they're just...
You did get to see a little early Tom of Finland art.
Is that right? Was that in it?
Yeah.
I didn't notice.
A little, if you're into the gay cartooning of Tom of Finland, yeah, they show one of his drawings.
Okay. I like that guy's gay art.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. And, yeah, so, yeah, this is fun to watch. It's fun to goof on. It's, like, fun to see how silly people were. And it's also nice to see some boobies, because they show a lot of those too. So, yeah, I thought this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I had never seen this one. You know, and much like you, I thought this was a lot of fun. Kind of funny timing for me, because I had just rewatched People vs. Larry Flint this past week. And I think if you are looking for like a short film to kind of pair together with People versus Larry Flint, this would probably be a pretty good one. You know, I guess the time period's a little bit different. This is like 10 years before Hustler was starting up, but I feel like, you know, mostly the same attitude still existed, you know, by the mid 70s, especially in places like Ohio. So, you know,
well, at the time that they made this in Cincinnati, because this is made in Cincinnati. We mentioned that. But
yeah, Charles Keating.
Yeah, again, yeah.
Who was the guy that went after Larry Flint?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But at the time that they were making this in Cincinnati, I feel like Larry Flint's bars in Dayton were probably open. He was probably starting things up around this time. So it's funny to see the kind of parallels between those two guys throughout
And that's
ages.
The funniest thing is, like, you know, living in Cincinnati and then just traveling less than an hour up to Dayton, which is the land of pornography and strip clubs. Like, you know, they still to this day have fucking peep shows and, you know, all kinds of strip clubs and porno stores right there on the main street downtown.
In Dayton, mm-hmm. But not in Cincy.
No, but that's what I'm saying. It's
good
like,
job,
it's
Cincinnati. Like, you're stupid.
Yeah, it's not like you had to travel far if you wanted to get a little pornography back in the day.
Yeah. It almost makes you feel like maybe some folks from Dayton were on like the city council of Cincinnati. You know what I mean? Like, let's drive some business, you know, to our town where we got all the pornos for you. But who knows?
That was Dayton's slogan on the signs for years was, we got all the porn.
Should never have changed it. I've always contended. But yeah, like I said, I had never seen this. Didn't know anything about this George Putnam guy that hosts this. Although I feel like I should know a little bit about this guy. If you look at his Wikipedia, apparently he was very famous for many decades. He had a bunch of radio shows, a bunch of TV shows over the years. I like the fact that he's credited in this as outstanding news reporter, that it actually says that on screen. I think it's pretty funny. But he's kind of the perfect casting for this kind of a, you know, uptight jerkwad that you would expect to be presenting something like this. You know, like, it's no surprise that by the end of this, he's repeatedly described gay and lesbian people as sexual deviants. Like, that seems to be one of his big talking points here. But almost to the point, actually, where it feels like by the end of it, like, it's one of those, like homeboy doth protest too much kind of scenarios, you know what I mean? Where it's like, all right, buddy, maybe you would meet me behind the arcade at the back of the drive-in. But I think he's fine.
Where do you think all those physique magazines ended up after they shot this?
Yeah.
They didn't go in the garbage, I assure you.
Probably came from his personal collection to begin with. But I like those magazines that he shows. I like those flashcards that he's showing, you know, throughout this thing. Like, he's in some Bob Dylan music video or something. These flashcards telling you that, you know, perversion should be depicted by a giant, weird, sad-looking octopus for some reason on one of these flashcards. yeah. That was fun. But he's cool. Yeah, he's got this like booming voice. He sounds kind of like the amazing Criswell, and he's got a lot of funny lines. You know, I like the part where he's reading the dialogue that's supposed to be like this monologue that like a gang member is giving. You know, and every time he encounters a slang term in this dialogue, he really like leans into it in a way that I love. So he'll say things like, one of the things that really cheesed me until now is how I'd never iced anyone until today. Just the way he leans into it is really fun. And I love that when he's talking about those nudie mags, you know, that are supposed to be ostensibly about nudists, you know, amateur nudists, he really stresses the fact that he's pissed about these featuring paid professional models, as if like he feels like he's ripped off or something. I thought that was kind of fun. Honestly, like, almost anything the guy says in this, you could like isolate and turn into a drop, to the point where I was taking notes on drops watching this, and then I just threw them all away because the whole thing is one long drop, you know. And actually, if you go on whosampled.com, there's four different songs listed that do sample this, including songs from Negative Land. So people have been mining this for the gold that is available in that, you know, in the narration. And I think that's a good thing. Also notable about George Putnam, besides the fact that he had a cameo in Independence Day as a newscaster, which I guess I should recognize him from that. The late Ted Knight once said that he used George Putnam as his model for the Ted Baxter character on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. So if you remember the newscaster Ted from Mary Tyler Moore, it was based on this George Putnam guy. I think that's kind of cool. But yeah, probably the big highlight of this is just that montage of the old magazine covers. You know, you get to see all these titles that I had never seen before. Titles like Fling, Follies, Gent, Spree, Rapture, which is, Rapture is a little bit of a weird one for like a sexy mag. And in my, it's the word Rapture, it's a little bit too close to, you know, suggesting sex crimes. But also some titles that I recognize like Swank or Chic, that I wonder, you know, are those the same magazines that I remember finding under my dad's bed as a kid, you know, in the 1980s? Or is there just, you know, another different Swank magazine from the 60s? Could be either way, but made me feel like I would buy a coffee table book of all these old covers of these nudie mags. If there isn't one out there already, I'm probably going to be looking online after this to see if there is one, because I think that would be cool, you know, that get all the full run of Spree in a coffee table book, you know, at least the covers. I think that would be sick. They also show some men's adventure magazines with painted covers that to me looked a little bit like the work that Basil Gogos did outside of Famous Monsters. And I love that art, you know, that real pulpy men's magazine art, I think is really cool. So I'd love to see that stuff. And yeah, I mean, it, you know, this thing kind of, it loses a little bit of steam by the end of it. I think it peaks in the middle with that montage of the magazines. And then after that, you get kind of like the boring courtroom reenactment, which is a little bit dull. Even if that guy who plays the judge did once make an appearance on the Batman TV show as a character named Gideon Peel, still pretty boring. But I think, you know, there's more than there's more good stuff in this than boring stuff. And certainly the highlights of this outweigh any negatives. So if you're a pervert out there and you haven't seen this, make some time. You know, this is out there. It's on YouTube. It's easy to find. And I think it's a great watch.
Very nice. Well, there you have it. If you want to see some old school porno and some old school hysteria over said porno, check out Perversion for Profit. Like I said, it's out there wherever internet videos reside. So check it out. All right, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to get into our next short film of the evening. And that is unedited footage of a bear from 2014. So stick around.
Being a mom is like having to be in two places at once.
Mom! Hey, Mom! Mom!
Mom!
Hey, Mom! Mom!
Mom!
That's when I stand my ground. With Claradryl.
Claradryl targets where you're most vulnerable, acts immediately, and lasts indefinitely.
So you can get back to what matters most. risk another minute. Take Claradryl and take life in your hands.
Claradryl may not be right for everyone. Consult your doctor if symptoms persist. Some patients experience side effects including dry mouth, dizziness, double vision, reflexive memory, aggression, and fatigue. Do not use if you suffer from high blood pressure or neurological dysfunction. Call your doctor if you experience an inability to concentrate, stiff muscles, sores, or trouble walking. Do not take Claire.
Welcome back to Junk Food Schlitzy. The next Schlitzy this evening is unedited footage of a bear from 2014. This is a movie directed, co-directed by Alan Resnick, who we last talked about when we talked about This House Has People in It. And I first saw this movie, I believe, right after seeing This House Has People in It, because I feel like I texted Frisbee about it or something. I was like, man, this house has people in it. This is nuts. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's old hat. I'd known about that for a long time. And you should watch unedited footage of a bear. So I did. And it's a bit different. I mean, they're very similar, but they're pretty different as well. Both of these were released on Adult Swim. They're short films. This one's 11 minutes long. Released on Adult Swim. I think this one came first. Let me verify that. This one's from 2011. This House Has People in It's from 2016. He's got a couple others. Released onto Adult Swim just in the middle of the night to instill the maximum amount of confusion among watchers. And I think if you were to catch this one night without knowing what it was, you would probably be pretty confused. In fact, we'll get into it, but it confused me a bit when I was watching it, and I knew what I was watching. It's called Unedited Footage of a Bear. When I started watching it, I just knew that it was by the same guy. It was probably going to be weird. I didn't know anything about it. And it's presented as what it says it is, unedited footage of a bear. So you get this footage, you get this bear footage. Also, I should say, if you're at all interested in this, this rules. Go watch it. It's on YouTube. It's on HBO Max. It's in places because we're going to like spoil the shit out of it. Like, you can't talk about it past the first 10 seconds without spoilers. So pause this. Go watch it. So you get the opening, which is the unedited footage of a bear.
Now tell me, who was the source of this videotape?
And a guy going, oh, my God, do you see that bear? And like, it's just like a home video of bear footage. And then it goes to commercial. And this is the part that caught me, because when you watch it on YouTube, YouTube has that little box in the corner that says, you know, ads coming up in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then you can get the option to skip the ad and, you know, after a few seconds and blah, blah, blah. And that shows up on the video. So I was like, man, you know, I need to skip this ad. I want to get back to whatever's happening. You can't skip it because it's part of the video. The commercial is now the video, and you're getting a commercial for like allergy medicine. And you're getting this lady hanging out, who's played by Carrie Donnelly, or Jacqueline Donnelly. Oh, it's Carrie. They're twins. Okay, that makes sense. So, yeah, it's this lady who's hanging out with her kids, and they're talking about, oh, try this medication. We've all seen medicine commercials before. It's exactly that for a while.
We've all seen Kids in the Hall brain candy.
We have seen that. So it's just, it seems like a real-ass commercial for a bit. In fact, when I watched this with the wife, she was like, why haven't you skipped this commercial? Like, it's the verisimilitude of it being a real commercial. It hits you for a minute. Until it starts getting weird. And this lady finds herself driving home while the announcer for the commercial is saying, you know, giving you the spiel about the side effects and blah, blah, blah. And she sees a crime that has occurred in her neighborhood. She keeps driving. We're still getting like fine print little details at the bottom of the screen because the commercial's not over yet. She sees a person in the middle of the street that attacks her. And then she just, I guess we're already spoiling it, but she's attacked by herself, a doppelganger. She is forced to kill the doppelganger. She runs back home. where even more weird shit happens and she just begins to lose her mind until she kills her kids. And it's shot in like all these weird ways. It's cutting back and forth between this and that, and you're still getting the fine print at the bottom telling you about possible side effects and things like that. And yeah, it turns from a nice little thing about a bear to abject horror in the span of 11 minutes. I think this is super cool. Like I said, if you don't know what you're getting into, it takes a lot of surprising turns. Even if you did know what you're getting into, like me, it takes a lot of surprising turns. And I think it serves anything with doppelgangers I'm going to like. So I like it for that reason. And I think it serves as a nice little critique of, demerchandising of pharmaceuticals, which I have no fucking idea how or why it's legal for drugs to be sold to people via commercials like this.
I like those drugs.
It seems like the kind of thing you doctor and you should figure out, rather than you being like, oh yeah, this one seems good, I better go get it. But that's a tangent for another time. So I think that this criticizes that kind of stuff well, kind of, and is also sort of allegorical for mental illness and stuff. And is most of all, it's just like weird and scary, and I think it's cool. So I'm excited to know what you guys think about unedited footage of a bear.
Well, I loved that prior short that we did from this Alan Resnick guy, This House Has People in It. I thought that was incredible. Still think about it from time to time, plan to go back and watch it again. Had a lot of fun with that one. But despite that, I still have not gone through anything else that this guy has made. He's got a few shorts out there. Just have not taken the time, kind of thinking and expecting that you would pick some of them for the show eventually. I also have not really gone through the infomercials series, at all on HBO Max, which is also kind of surprising to me because I the few that I've seen, whether it's this or Too Many Cooks or whatever, I've loved all of them. So I feel like I should be taking more deep dives. Maybe part of it is it's rare for me to be in the mood where I'm like seeking out a 10-minute slice of entertainment. I think that's one reason why I like having this kind of week on the show every month, because it's pretty rare for me to be like, you know what, I'm going to spend time and find something that will only consume 10 minutes of my day. Sometimes I'll stumble upon those, you log into your YouTube and, it's recommending things at the top, maybe I might click on one of those, but, usually if I'm going to be making plans to sit down and watch something, I want something that's between 80 and 180 minutes. You know what I mean? And so, yeah. So anyways, I didn't really know what to expect from this other than, having high hopes based on really liking this guy's stuff. And I think ultimately, there were a few things that I really did like in this. Like I really liked the Cool Beans poster that one of the kids had in their bedrooms. I thought that was fun. And I liked this setting, like this twisting of this generic, supposedly idyllic track house kind of neighborhood, almost looks like the neighborhood from the first Poltergeist movie, transforming that into like this unsettling hellscape, I think is really cool, and they do a good job at doing it, with these weird, vertigo zooms and stuff, and just unsettling camera angles and stuff like this in the first half of this. I thought that stuff was good, and I liked the tiny disclaimer text, at the bottom of the screen that continues throughout this entire short. They keep warning you about, potential side effects and stuff like this. There's one that makes reference to some users of this pharmaceutical experiencing potential suicide attempts or completed suicides. And the phrase completed suicides, I don't know why, just tickles my fancy. I think it's funny. And I think the lead actress or actresses, I actually didn't realize it was a pair of twins here. They're very good. It's a pretty demanding role for these leads here. A lot of screaming and crying and, being scared and, it's pretty intense stuff. And they handle it great. But beyond that, I don't know, I was kind of struggling to connect with this thing. And I think part of it is, and this is not me trying to act like I'm too cool for school or something, or some TV watching genius or something, because I think I'm far from that. But to me, when it switched into the fake commercial, like immediately I was like, well, this is not the actual production style of a real commercial. Like this looks, you know, too artful in certain ways for this to actually be a real commercial. And it's one of those things where I can't even really quantify exactly what it was. But it just didn't feel right. It was just like, oh yeah, this is not a commercial. This is a goof on a commercial immediately. And so I didn't really get fully immersed. Part of that might also be that I watched this on HBO Max. Maybe if they, you know, got me on YouTube with that skip now button, maybe that would have changed the experience for me. But so when I wasn't fully immersed in that kind of conceit and I wasn't tricked and I knew right away, well, this is just a parody of a pharmaceutical commercial, I was waiting for it to kind of build on that. And it, I mean, it does kind of immediately when she first encounters the, you know, doppelganger of herself. But then beyond that, it's just kind of one note. Like that's the whole thing is like, okay, this descent into madness, which is centered mostly around this, you know, encounter with this doppelganger. And then by the end of it, I was just kind of like, okay, well, you know, that happened. I watched it. Okay. But I didn't really get invested because I thought it might, I don't know, make a different turn. I was like waiting for it to make a different left turn or something into some unexpected territory. But it kind of doesn't. It just kind of sets those, admittedly, you know, very high stakes, but it sets them immediately and then doesn't really do anything else with it. And then the very end of this, like the editing is so chaotic that I just kind of got confused, and maybe if I rewatch this, I might appreciate that segment more, but like, it feels like some real chaos editing there at the end where things are just flashing through real quick and I wasn't really sure what the fuck was happening. So yeah, honestly, I came out of this just kind of slightly confused and not really sure what I saw, but maybe that's part of the point. But I didn't really love the experience either, you know, especially compared to This House Has People in It. And maybe that was, you know, the big issue here is just expectations, you know, and maybe now knowing what this is, counterintuitively, maybe, you know, knowing exactly the shape of this and rewatching it might be more rewarding for me, despite the fact that I think that they're trying to do this big surprise kind of left turn that for me didn't land. But, you know, definitely glad to have seen it and open to seeing more of this guy's stuff, because I think he is a really interesting filmmaker.
Yeah, interesting is a good way to put this. I didn't love This House Has People in It. I thought that was just kind of weirdness and for the sake of weird. What I do like, though, about these, especially when they were aired originally on Adult Swim, is that they would just air these in the middle of the night, like where they would normally show like infomercials and stuff. And I just love the idea of, you know, just somebody falling asleep watching Family Guy or something and then waking up at 4 a.m. and like half asleep, like catching this from the beginning. I mean, like, what? And then just continuing with it and just the whole way just being like, what the fuck? Like, what am I watching? Like, am I really seeing this? Am I asleep? Am I dreaming? Like, that I love. Like, and the same thing with, you know, any of these, you know, like the, you know, Too Many Cooks or some of the other ones that we've watched, you know, that have been part of this Adult Swim kind of short film thing. I like that idea of just, especially like, imagine like an older person, you know what I mean? Like some grandma coming across this at 4 a.m. and just not knowing what the hell to make of it. Like that I love. But as somebody, you know, watching this, knowing what Adult Swim does and knowing, you know, already seeing a couple of these, so knowing that it's, you know, what the kind of the gag's going to be. It's going to, you know, start off somewhat normal and then just progressively get delved further and further into madness. Yeah, I don't know. It loses steam a little pretty quickly, like Sean said. I mean, once the initial conceit is, you know, given up that like, okay, yeah, it's this like parody of a medicine commercial that's just getting weirder and weirder, and you know, it doesn't really, expand on it too far from that. I mean, you know, it just follows this lady into her house as things get weirder and weirder with her doppelganger. Things get like crazy violent, and there's just like these weird cuts, and the lady's clearly nuts, and you know, it gets weird. I mean, it definitely brings the weird. There's no shortage of that. But yeah, once you kind of get the gist of the joke, you know, you kind of get it. You're like, okay, I get it. I'm done. And then it goes on for another 3 minutes. But yeah, you know, it's a short thing. It's like, what, 10 minutes? So it's not a huge investment by any means. It's hard to get mad at it. It is just one of those weird kind of, you know, goofball things that's maybe fun to watch once or show to a friend, especially unsolicited. Again, I think the best pot, like this is like a, you know, this is like a prank you buy at the store, you know, like the gum that tastes bad, or the fart candy, or the cigarette burn, or a whoopee cushion. You know, this is that. You put this on, you trick a friend with it, and you have your fun. But other than that, I don't see a whole lot of value in this. But it was fun to watch once.
Fun to watch once. I think that sums it up, I guess. I don't know. I've watched this twice. I still like it. But yeah, all right. Yeah, sounds about right. Maybe we'll watch some of this guy's other stuff in the future. This is the only other one I've watched, so... So I'm still on his side. But we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about kaijus. Stick around.
For the last 7 years, Kevin, Sean, and Parker have gone hundreds of dollars in debt because of Junk Food Dinner. Between buying every out-of-print eBay copy of Gutterballs, Donald Lloyd's t-shirt fees, and paying the lawyers for those gag orders on Mark, JFD is bankrupt. Log on to patreon.com/junkfooddinner and donate a few bucks to keep JFD going another 7 years. And to get awesome bonuses while you're at it, donate now so the boys don't have to get real jobs.
Back to Junk Food Dinner. The next movie on the show tonight's going to be Kaiju Bunraku. This is a 2017 short film directed by Lucas Leiva and Jillian Meyer, a directing team who has done about 8 short films together in the past 10 years or so. This one is a 13-minute long short available on YouTube, Vimeo, and elsewhere that combines the great Japanese traditions of bunrakus and kaijus which could mean only one thing, and that is...
it's time.
Now, I'm telling these son of a bitches that we respect the Japanese of this country.
It's July.
It's time. For the final week, it is July Panese, because this is a Japanese-themed movie. I guess technically not a Japanese movie. I think both these filmmakers are, in fact, American, but, you know, it's close enough. I first saw this not too long ago, about a few months ago, when we were first talking off-air about doing a Kaiju Lai theme show. I figured, you know what, you know, July is coming up. I should probably, you know, pair a Kaiju theme short together with our, you know, Kaiju Lai features. And that was kind of the genesis for this whole, this big shebang that everybody's talking about on the internet, this July Panese vertical theme month that I was doing. And because honestly, like when I searched Kaiju short film, this was one of the very few that came back. You know, there are some other ones, you know, some officially produced Toho shorts here and there, but not a whole lot, you know. And this one came up as being recommended, and I watched it and I loved it. I figured it would be good for the show. This, like I mentioned, is kind of a combination of Kaiju traditions and Bunraku, which is a form of traditional Japanese puppet theater that I guess started out in Osaka back in the 17th century, according to Wikipedia. But it's basically, you get these guys who wear like all black costumes, including like masks with hoods to kind of black out their entire bodies. And, you know, they're the puppeteers, and they're holding these highly detailed wooden dolls that they, you know, perform as puppets. And it's, you know, it's, like I said, traditional form. It's something that I've been kind of curious about. You know, you see it here and there in Japanese media, but I've never sat down and watched an entire Bunraku performance or anything like that. But I've always been curious, you know, and never really knew how to get into it. You know, I don't know that there are a ton of, you know, English subtitled Bunraku performances available to me. Maybe there are. I just didn't know where to start. So anyways, this seemed like a good place to get into it. And I always, you know, I already liked Kaiju and, you know, two great tastes going together. Anyways, you know, the story is fairly simple. You know, although they do overlay it with a lot of poetic musings from this narrator that's kind of exploring the emotions of the characters. But the story is simple, and it just basically involves this husband and wife in an old-timey Japanese village living in a world that is dominated by kaijus. And in the first half of this short, their village gets destroyed once again. This is like a repeated thing that happens in this world, and their village gets destroyed by a kaiju, you know, while they take shelter in a cave. So they survive, but you know, their village does not. And then after that, the husband kind of resolves to stand up to the kaiju in his own way, or at least not hide anymore. He doesn't want to live a life of hiding, sheltered in this cave. He's going to just stay out there and face the beast the next time it shows up. And that's sort of it plot-wise. You know, of course, the beast does show up at the end. Whether or not we want to spoil who the monster is specifically, I guess we can figure that out as we talk about this, but I'll shy away from that for now. Suffice it to say, though, I think the puppet that they use for the monster at the end looks fucking cool as all hell. I love this puppet that they got. and, you know, stylistically, it's, I think, pretty close to what a Bunraku play really would be. You know, like they do employ filmmaking techniques like, you know, close-up camera angles and editing, of course, you know, and camera movements and stuff like this. But like the whole style of the puppets and the sets that they use and, you know, overall the scope of it seems to be pretty faithful to what a Bunraku performance should be. And I think that's what I liked most about this, is that it seems to be very respectful of the form, you know, of this form of puppetry, you know, and it's got a sense of humor. You know, there's funny little parts. There's a rant that the husband goes on about how he's constantly having to deal with these mutant praying mantises and these cyborg dragons from space, and he's kind of jawing about that, and that's funny. But they don't really, you know, use the puppetry as a source of humor. You know, it's not like a Team America kind of thing, which I think maybe even those guys would admit they maybe leaned on that too much in terms of like, you know, making puppetry look silly and just kind of having that be the joke. You know, they're finding jokes on top of paying respect to this art form. And for me, I think that's cool because this is probably one of those art forms that, you know, if you don't get younger people interested in it, will probably die off, you know? So I like all that stuff. And, you know, I like that it's respectful also to kaijus. You know, I think you get the sense watching this that this creative team really loves kaiju movies. You know, they have no interest in, like, taking the piss out of them so much as giving them a loving homage, which I think is really sweet. And, you know, it feels very Japanese despite, you know, like I said, it being an American creative team here. There's a real sense of authenticity here. You know, like when the monster does show up, they subtitle it in both English and Japanese, you know, as it would be in a traditional kaiju movie. And, you know, much also like a traditional kaiju movie, there is a bit of like waiting for the monster to show up. You know, he doesn't show up until the very last couple minutes, but I think it's worth the wait. And it's, you know, you're waiting like 10 minutes at the most. So it's not like you're waiting 80 minutes, you know, through a feature for it. So I guess this is probably not 100% to everyone's tastes out there. You know, this is a very specific kind of a tone, but I think if you like these two things, this will be right up your alley, because how many things are there out there that combine these two disparate but awesome segments of Japanese culture, you know? And so for me, this just kind of aligned perfectly with my own interests, and I think the execution was really good. I like this kind of sparse, minimalist Japanese traditional music, you know, with the taiko drums and all that stuff. I like how the puppets look. I like these meandering, thoughtful monologues that the husband goes on. And yeah, it's just nice to see somebody out there doing new things with this very old form, you know, and keeping it relevant and keeping it fresh. But had you guys heard of this outside of the voicemail that we got about it last week? And what did you think?
Yeah, I had not. This is new to me. I really didn't know what to expect. I honestly, and pardon my ignorance, did not even know what Bunraku was. But I do enjoy technical Muppetry, as we've established on the show. So I was open and willing to learn more about this Japanese art form that I didn't know anything about. And yeah, immediately I was, you know, intrigued by the puppetry. You know, I like, you know, like I said, technical puppetry of all kinds, whether it be, you know, the Henson style, whether it be marionette, whether it be animatronics, or, you know, in this case, like you said, kind of these shadow puppeteers in, you know, black body suits manipulating these detailed wooden marionette slash puppets. And, you know, I thought they had some cool movements, and I liked the way that they interacted with each other. And it did feel, like you said, very authentic. I'm the wrong person to judge the authenticity of a Bunraku, not even knowing what it was a mere week ago. But it did feel like, I mean, you know, a Japanese folklore, and like it was, you know, being true to that style. Again, I have no point of reference, so my opinion might not mean dick, but it was fun for me. And then obviously, being a kaiju fan, the fact that they wove that piece of Japanese pop culture into this kind of traditional Japanese folklore and storytelling, I thought was cool and interesting. And yeah, I thought the story, while, you know, brief and kind of, you know, we've kind of all heard the story before, but I did feel like it worked well in this scenario. And it also felt almost kind of timely, as you could definitely use the kaiju as a metaphor for the coronavirus. And I think it still kind of applies and feels timely in that regard as well. But yeah, I thought it was cool. And like you said, the kaiju that shows up at the end, it is a name brand kaiju. They name names. It wasn't just a generic one. And I do like the fact that they reference like actual kaiju, like King Ghidorah and Mecha King Ghidorah. And like you said, there are some humorous elements where they talk about, you know, having radioactive piss and stuff after these kaiju attacks. So that was all fun. And yeah, the ending, I think, brought it all around and made it an overall very entertaining pick. You know, it's a curiosity for sure. It's not going to be for everybody. If you're not a fan of kaiju and the idea of old school Japanese puppetry isn't exactly, you know, blowing your dick back, then you might not love this. It might not be for you, but this is, for those who it is for, I think is going to be a home run. And it was for me. I thought this was a good time, and I'm very intrigued to see what these filmmakers do going forward.
I also want to see what these filmmakers do for going forward and backwards, because I watched one of their other ones. I watched I Am Your Grandma, which I thought was very fun as well. But yeah, so
I am not a 1979 housewife.
So yeah, I think this is super fun. I loved this. I like this style of technical Muppetry where with the, you know, the shadow cast and stuff. Like, I think it looks cool. I mean, it, you know, it's like, you know, I mean, there's obviously there's, you know, it's a much different kind than Jim Henson setting up, you know, an elaborate tunnel system underneath a pond so that, you know, you never see him puppeting Kermit or whatever. But I think it works. You know, it's, if you're into the story, you don't see those people really. Like, you're paying attention to the puppets, and it's a simple and effective way to do this. And I think it's really cool. And I mean, yeah, the story is super great. Like, just like the, you know, this dude just philosophizing about how horrible his life is because of these goddamn kaijus. I would love to see an entire movie about this, like in this style or with actual actors. I think it would make for an interesting story to tell. There's a Marvel comic called, I forget what it's called, like Damage Squad or something like this, where it's about the people who go in and are paid to clean up after superhero fights in Manhattan and stuff. And just, it just kind of follows their mundane lives cleaning up, after the fun stuff happened. And this is very similar to that. It's, you know, just these people are sick of it. The first few times they saw a kaiju, it was probably very exciting, and now they're just kind of done with it, and it sucks, and it ruins their lives. And it's, you know, very funny. It's very absurd and over the top. But it's also like very, you know, it's told in a very subdued kind of philosophical way, that I like the way that those two things sort of juxtapose with each other. And when the kaiju shows up at the end, I'm going to spoil it. So go watch this if you don't want spoilers.
But it's okay.
It's Mothra that shows up. And I love this.
But larva form, yeah. Mothra. Not fully butterflied out Mothra.
This is a special edition Mothra.
True. And I saw someone on Letterboxd who, I mean, they were probably like half joking, but they were like, oh, this movie's bullshit because Mothra's a good guy and this wouldn't happen. But that's exactly the point of this, is like, even the good guy kaijus kill, like, just destroy hundreds of thousands of people in an effort to take out the bad guy kaijus. Like, there are no real good guy kaijus. Like, they're going to trample your garden no matter if they're good or bad.
So we're talking death?
And so I think that that's why Mothra was probably chosen. And just, I mean, they probably had just a cool concept for that puppet as well, I suppose. But
I think Mothra has alternated between good and evil, like most of the kaijus, right?
That's probably true. So I liked seeing Mothra. I thought it was good. But yeah, this is great. I would like to watch some more stuff from these people, some more stuff about kaijus, some more bunrakus. It's my understanding after reading something like three sentences about it, so maybe this is completely wrong, that it is a very comical sort of over the top, like absurdist. It's a way to tell like very absurd stories. And so I think that like I said, the juxtaposition between like the very calm puppets and the absurd stories they're telling, if that is a trope of this art form in general, then I would very much like to become more of a fan of it. So I thought this was super cool.
Awesome. And yeah, let's get that Kappa Bunraku movie greenlit, right? How about that? You want to talk about absurdity? Let's get a giant Kappa puppet. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
I'd love to see it.
Glad that you guys enjoyed this. Glad that this is out there. I urge everybody out there, you know, who's listening, check this out. Give these guys a view on their YouTube, you know what I mean? Because it's a cool little movie that they made. But I think that about wraps it up for Kaiju Bunraku. We will take a quick break, and when we come back, we will devolve into our larval form, so stick around.
Thank you for listening to this Junk Food Dinner. Wrapping it up. next week, we'll be back, of course, with some more hot fire for you guys. Let me find it on the website because I clicked the wrong one. We're in a whole new month now. That's how fast time moves these days. We're going to be joined by Zach from the Shuffle Repeat podcast. It's a podcast that I was on. The episode that I was on where we talk about ska music will be up probably around the time that next week's episode is up. So we'll let you know how to find that. We will be talking about Stunt Rock from 1978, finally, The Burrowers from 2008, and Cinemania from 2002. So that's going to be a hot program. So I'm very excited for that one. If you don't want to wait, you know, if you're like, man, a whole week for another Junk Food Dinner, that fucking sucks. You can go to patreon.com/junkfooddinner, throw down a couple of dollars. You can get our entire catalog of bonus episodes. These bonus episodes are hot fire. We're in there arguing about the best horror directors of all time. We're in there arguing about snack foods. We're in there arguing about what the best movies of 1977 are. It's good stuff. For just a couple of dollars more, you can get to pick the movies that we do on this show. So that's a fun thing. And for a very few dollars, you can get stuff like our movie list a little bit early. Sometimes I throw up extra bonus podcasts where I just talk to myself. It's a great deal. Very economical. You can call us 347-746-JUNK. Let us know if you have any regrets. Let us know if Shelby should have been on for State Park, things like that. You can also email us at jftpodcast@gmail.com to let us know those things. If you want to, if you want to remain anonymous when you're telling us your regrets, I guess that would be fine. So I guess that's everything. Until next time, this is Parker for Kevin and Sean saying thanks for having fun.